Hey, I'm Michaela Lafrac, co-host of Vermont Edition. I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. Today on the show, we'll be joined by one of the five Democratic candidates for Vermont's seat in the U.S. House, Dr. Lewis Myers. He's a physician working in Rutland and currently the only male candidate in the Democratic field. But first, Vermont's legislative session adjourned just a few days ago. A lot of bills were passed at the State House this session. Lawmakers, for one, passed an $8.1 billion budget that included many of Governor Phil Scott's funding priorities, such as affordable housing, broadband access, and education. There were also a lot of disagreements. Legislators passed major pension reforms after both chambers unanimously overruled the governor's veto. There were also some issues left unresolved. For one, the Clean Heat Standard bill, which supporters said could have helped the state meet its emission reduction targets. Here to discuss all of these issues and more is our very own Bob Kinzel, senior political reporter at VPR. Welcome back to the show, Bob.
Michaela, great to be here.
We're also joined today by Lola Dufour, a political reporter for VT Digger covering Vermont's state government. Welcome back to you as well, Lola.
Hi, Michaela. Thanks for having me.
What are your questions or thoughts on the 2022 legislative session? Join the conversation. Give us a call at 800-639-2211. You can also email us at vermontedition@vpr.org or tweet us at Vermont Edition. We'd love to hear from you about the bills that you cared about that passed or didn't, or any questions for our panelists. So, Bob, I'd love to start with you, and let's take a short trip down memory lane here to start. Now, this session started out over Zoom due to COVID and the Omicron variant, and lawmakers eventually made their way back to doing business in person for the first time since before the pandemic. In your opinion, Bob, how did the tone of the session shift when it went from Zoom to in person?
Michaela, I think it made a big difference. Lawmaking is one of those things where I think it's important for legislators to be there in person, to talk with each other, have thoughts about for and against different bills, meeting in the hallway. And to do it all by Zoom was just very rigid. The people I really felt sorry for were the new lawmakers elected in November of 2020. Who then had the 2021 session totally remote, and then the first third of this session remote, they had to have had a very different experience. And there have been some people who felt that it's a better legislative process when people are there in person, and I would definitely concur with that.
Lola, what do you think? Do you think that having the session back to in person potentially led to more compromises and deals?
I mean, I think it's hard to say whether or not it produced better legislation or more thoughtful legislation. I do think people were happy to be back in the building by and large. I think it made it more fun for a lot of lawmakers that were very burned out by Zoom. I'm a little bit more skeptical that things have to happen in person or on Zoom. I also think that this was quite useful for those lawmakers who had family obligations that were kind of better able to tend to both, but it did seem like people by and large were happy to be back in the building once they were.
And before we dive into some of the specific bills that went through or didn't go through this session, let's talk big overarching takeaways. Lola, for you, what were some of your big takeaways from this session?
I thought the session was interesting for the quite large things that were ultimately accomplished. I was very surprised by some of the wins that lawmakers were able to get for themselves. I fully did not expect that a pension compromise would come together. And I certainly didn't expect it to be approved unanimously, then vetoed, then overridden unanimously. That was a pretty big surprise.
It's a rocky road.
It's a rocky road, but it's also, this is such a thorny, difficult kind of political third rail. Mm-hmm. And to see it come together again, like I didn't expect it. And some of the failures were also quite surprising. I think Clean Heat is definitely one of those, both for kind of the import that it would have had, right? It was the state's kind of best attempt at trying to meet its emissions goals, which, you know, it can now be sued for if it doesn't meet. And it was also, I mean, the way that it fell apart was very interesting.
Well, since you brought up the Clean Heat standard, let's pause there on it and kind of dive into it, because I know a lot of folks have heard this phrase, the Clean Heat standard. They're thinking it was going to be a thing, and now it's not a thing. Can you talk us through what exactly happened?
Yeah, well, so the Clean Heat Standard, it's probably useful to kind of start with what that is. Yes. And that basically establishes a credit system for the state's heating sector, so home heating. And it's important because home heating is basically, I think, the second largest source of emissions for the state. And the kind of linchpin of the climate action plan that Vermont came up with was the Clean Heat Standard, which was kind of criticized, you know, as much as it was kind of like the best possible thing that lawmakers put forward. It was criticized on the right for, you know, concerns that it might raise prices for Vermonters, and that it delegated too much responsibility away from the legislature. And it was also criticized by some environmentalists that were very concerned about the inclusion of biofuels as a quote unquote clean heat source, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was still expected to substantially, hopefully, reduce the state's emissions. And it was vetoed by the governor. And lawmakers in the House believed that they had the 100 votes that they needed to override it. And they basically discovered on the floor that actually they only had 99 votes and the override failed. So it was pretty dramatic.
Yes. Well, speaking of dramatic situations in the House, Bob, for you, what stands out from this session that surprised you, or some of your own big takeaways?
Well, I guess I think I would have two. I would just follow up with Lola said about clean heat. You know, the governor vetoed the bill, and as what he did with many bills that he vetoed, he said, here's a path forward. If you mm-hmm. want to pass this legislation, here's what you need to do. And in this case, he made it very clear that the recommendations from the Public Utilities Commission, which would be developed over the next couple of years, this whole credit system that Lola mentioned, that he wanted those recommendations, those regulations to come back in bill form to the legislature, where lawmakers would have to specifically vote on it, and he would have an opportunity to either sign the bill or veto it. He made it very clear that he wanted that. Lawmakers said, well, we did that. We put that in the bill. I looked at that section. It seemed a little vague to me. And one of the great mysteries for me of this session is why the two sides could not come together and just agree on the wording of what that reflection by the legislature in 2 years would be. I just don't understand why it was so difficult. I think it also points out the difficulty when you have a split in the environmental community. You know, as Lola mentioned, biofuels was a big controversial issue. The Conservation Law Foundation said no. The Sierra Club said no. 350.org said no. In favor of the bill, you had VPIRG and VNRC. So I think a lot of lawmakers looked at this and said, well, geez, the environmental community is split. What is going on here? But to the bigger picture, I would just say money, money, money. The legislature has never had this much money to spend on a lot of things. The governor referred to this as once-in-a-lifetime investments, and we saw that in affordable housing. We saw it in economic development. We saw it in broadband. even some climate initiatives, money for the Vermont State College system. There used to be a time when $1 million was a lot of money at the State House. But when we're talking about an $8 billion budget, all of a sudden, hey, we need $1 million for this program, doesn't seem like a big ask.
Listeners, we're discussing the 2022 legislative session, which just wrapped up last week with VPR's Bob Kinzel and VT Digger's Lola Dufort. If you have questions about the session, what was accomplished or what wasn't accomplished, give us a call, 800-639-2211. All right, Bob, back to this $8.1 billion budget that you just brought up. Lots of money in here for lots of different things. I'm curious if any of the numbers surprised you, if there was anything that you think didn't get addressed or perhaps, you know, received a lot of funding that you were thinking maybe wouldn't.
You know, I was just surprised by how many different programs got so much money. So there was so much federal money involved. We also had a pretty large state general fund surplus. So when we say, geez, $90 million for broadband, that sounds like a lot of money. $80 million just for the weatherization program. That sounds like a lot of money. And you have some economic development programs to address workforce issues. That's another $90 million. And then you had $40 million to help some businesses that have really been adversely affected by the pandemic. There's a loan program for some of those businesses. You have all this money for affordable housing. That's, you know, another $90 million in subsidies, as well as $20 million to help rehab some old apartments and housing across the state. So, you know, as you look at any one of these, Michaela, you say, boy, in any given year, that would have been a lot of money. But now you can probably point to a dozen things that are being addressed that were on a wish list for many years.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bob, you bring up affordable housing, which is, of course, one of the major issues in the state right now. And a number of bills passed will try to address this shortage. A lot of them, I noticed, provide funding for construction of new housing. But as we know, construction can take years. Lola, in your perspective, do you think any of the bills that address affordable housing offer more short-term solutions for Vermonters?
Well, there's some money for example, like rental, the VHIP program will get $20 million, and that's for kind of rehabilitating code-violating properties. So you would think that that will go a little faster than, you know, building from scratch, which will indeed probably take years. There's some money like that. There is not a lot of for example, protections for tenants in the meantime. A just cause charter change in Burlington also failed to make its way through the legislature after the governor vetoed it and the House failed to override a rental registry, which was also viewed as a consumer protection program for renters, was scrapped at the last minute to dodge a veto from the governor. I think by and large, in order to see the dividends from these investments, it's going to take a while. I don't think that folks looking for help in the market right now are going to see very immediate impacts.
Well, let's go to the phones now. And listeners, if you have questions for Bob or Lola or comments about this recent legislative session, give us a call, 800-639-2211. Let's go to Bill in South Burlington. Bill, you're on the air. Go ahead.
I was curious what changed with the state pension bill that had been turned down several times before this. And do you think that $220 million to spend on that was sort of like rewarding a union that never upped their contributions, and now we're bailing them out with state tax funds?
Bob, curious for your thoughts here. What led to this approval of this, the pension reform?
I think the problem was so large and so many people saw it as a gigantic problem for the state of Vermont that it had to be dealt with as soon as possible. We were looking at between a $5 and $6 billion unfunded liability in the pension funds. Now, there are a whole host of reasons why this happened. During the 1990s, when times were tight, the legislature underfunded their requirements for the pension fund, thinking, oh, it's doing okay. You know, we can always catch up some other time. Well, you do that for 10 years and that starts to add up. The other thing that happened was some of the investments were not very good, and they did not yield the kind of interest and revenue that they had previously. So you had that problem. And then you have this huge demographic issue, which a whole lot of people are retiring. A number of people in Vermont over 65 is growing substantially. So you had more people pulling off of the pension fund. So it was one of those issues. I think everybody felt there's got to be a solution. We cannot, you know, kick the can down the road, so to speak, for another year. And freeing up $200 million in public funds to sort of buy down some of that debt was a very important step to take. The cost of living index has been adjusted, so it's not quite as generous as it was in the past. There will be some increases in pension contributions for employees based on their incomes. So it was a case where I think everybody gave a little bit and they came up with a compromise that worked.
Bob, one thing that a lot of Vermonters have had their eyes on this year are tax cuts. And this is one of those areas where Governor Scott seems to have gotten some of what he wanted, but not everything. So can you break this down for us? How should Vermonters expect their taxes to change?
You know, Michaela, I think this is actually a pretty textbook case of everybody got a little bit of what they wanted.
To
review it. Yeah. I mean, to review it briefly, the idea was there was about $50 million available in a general fund surplus for a tax cut. The House came in with a plan. The Senate had a plan. And right at the beginning of January, Governor Scott outlined his plan. You might remember that Scott wanted to change the income threshold at which Social Security benefits are subject to state taxes. That was a dramatic move on his part. He also wanted to increase the earned income tax credit and the child care and dependent care tax credit. And a big priority for the governor was to exempt military pension benefits from state income taxes. The House took a look at that idea and said, we're going to go in a totally different direction. And the centerpiece of the House plan was a child tax credit. And it also addressed some of the Social Security concerns, but nothing the way that the governor did. So the child tax credit was the big, big piece of the House plan. Well, the Senate got a hold of it and said, you know, the House has got some good ideas. Governor's got some good ideas. We have some ideas. We're going to sort of mix all this together and come out with a compromise. And that's what it does. It includes a scaled back child tax credit program. It's not as generous as the House originally had. It does allow filers to deduct student loan interest payments. It does expand the income tax threshold for Social Security by $5,000. So now if you're an individual in Vermont and you have an overall income of $50,000 or less, you do not pay any state taxes on your Social Security benefits. And that would be true for joint filers up to $70,000. There are some tax credits for child care and dependent care services. There's also an exemption of $10,000 for military pension benefits, not what the governor wanted, but it's a step in that direction. So I really do think the final compromise was a little bit of all three plans.
Well, Lola, while we're on this subject of taxes and on compromise, there are some changes happening in regards to education funding and property taxes. What's the story there?
Right. This was actually another example of something that I didn't expect would come to fruition, because it is another one of these like very complicated, extremely thorny issues, and that's education funding. So I guess we should start with kind of explaining the way it works in Vermont, which is that there's a statewide grant list, right? property taxes are not raised off of an individual district's tax base. It's statewide. But how much you pay in education property taxes depends on how much your district spends, quote unquote, per pupil, which kind of, you know, helps with cost containment. But how the state comes up with that number, that per pupil number, is based off of this weighted formula. And that's because there's this understanding that some kids are going to cost more to educate, right? If you have a large proportion of kids living in poverty, you're probably going to have to spend more on things like social services and house, et cetera. And so this formula is supposed to take that into account. Back in 2019, a report came back to the legislature that said, this weighted formula that you have been using, it's completely arbitrary. It does not at all take into account the real cost of educating certain types of students. You've got to rejigger the whole formula. Here are better weights. And the reason that that is, you know, such a difficult thing to do is because the education fund is a self-contained system, which means that if you put downward pressure on property taxes in one district, you put upward pressure on taxes in another district. But lawmakers came up with a plan and pushed it through. It'll have like a multi-year phase in that will basically adjust those weights. And at the end of the day, what we're expecting to see is that school districts with, you know, high proportions of kids in poverty, more English language learners, that they will have basically an increased spending capacity. And that also passed with pretty overwhelming support in both chambers, which is surprising. Another thing is that there was a $100 million surplus in the state's education fund. And that was thanks to, you know, all the federal stimulus spending. And $100 million surplus in the education fund is a big deal. We don't often see that. About $20 million of that is going to be used to reduce property tax rate statewide. Although the thing to keep in mind with a lower tax rate is that if the assessments on people's homes have skyrocketed as they have, doesn't mean that you're going to see like a huge tax cut. About $29 million of that surplus is being used on universal meals. Lawmakers agreed to, you know, keep universal free meals in place across all schools in Vermont for another year, but they haven't figured out a long-term funding source. But they use part of the surplus to kind of deal with that for 1 year. And then there's also $22 million that's going towards a fund for remediating PCBs because the state is in the process of testing basically all schools for these toxic chemicals to see if we have, you know, a whole bunch of Burlington high schools out there. Burlington High School had to basically shut down and is now operating out of the Macy's because of high levels of these chemicals. So the state put some money away to hopefully start thinking about how to pay for that problem once we have a better picture of what that looks like statewide.
Well, lots of developments here. Bob, anything to add on these topics?
You know, first of all, I thought Lola did a great job explaining how education is funded in Vermont. It is one of the most complicated things in the world. What I'm going to be fascinated to watch over the next couple of years is, does this bill do what its proponents hope it will do? Or are we going to see the law of unintended consequences rear its head? Now, let me just explain that. As Lola mentioned, it's going to give some school districts additional capacity to fund programs. These are going to be districts with a high number of children in poverty or English learners. It gives them the opportunity to spend more money. Now, the school district could say, you know, rather than spend more money, I think we're going to lower our tax rate. And so even though they have the capacity to spend more money, some might not take advantage of it. Some might not. Conversely, the towns, as Lola mentioned, when some people gain, some people lose, you're going to have some towns that have a very low number of children in poverty or English learners, and they're going to see that they're going to have to raise their tax rate in order to keep their current level of spending. Now, they might decide, hey, we don't want to raise taxes. We're going to have to get by with a little less money. So that's what could unfold with this bill. In the House Ways and Means Committee, there was concern that this could actually happen and might happen, and so that the goals of the people who sponsored this legislation might not be met. It's just something to keep an eye on in the coming years.
And I should also note, if listeners, if you have an interest in learning more about how the state funds education, there's a great episode of VPR's People-Powered Journalism Project, Brave Little State, reported out by our very own Pete Hirschfeld, that is all about education funding. And you can find that in the Brave Little State podcast feed. Let's go down to Jim in Barrytown. Jim, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, I have two questions. I'm a little confused about the marijuana stuff and what was passed. My first one is, how much land can someone cultivate plants on? And the second question I'm confused on is the 60% potency. And I'll listen. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Jim. Now, Bob, you've been following the new cannabis, retail cannabis marketplace for VPR. Briefly, we only have a couple minutes left here, but do you have any responses for Jim here?
Sure. The Cannabis Control Board really wants to fill the supply of cannabis in Vermont when the retail marketplace opens on October 1st with small growers. These are called Tier 1. It's 1,000 square feet, which is pretty darn small. I don't know if it's easier to think about it as a bowling alley or a quarter of the size of a basketball court, whichever one works for you. But it's a pretty small plot of land, and that's what it's hoping to do. It wants to stay away from these 50,000 square foot growing enterprises. So far, right now, licenses have been issued this week to the first Tier 1 growers. And on the 60% threshold, it was decided that for concentrates, and I'm in a little over my head on this one, but for solid concentrates, there is a 60% THC capacity, but that is not true for liquid or oil-based products. So that was a compromise with the Vermont Medical Association.
Now, before we wrap up this conversation, I want to make sure we get to one of the most important legislative accomplishments of 2022 that won't actually come to pass until later this year, when voters weigh in on a proposed constitutional amendment to guarantee reproductive liberty in Vermont. Lola, can you give us a brief overview of Prop 5?
Yeah, Prop 5 basically will enshrine the right to, enshrine reproductive rights into the Vermont state constitution, which is interpreted to mean both, you know, a right to abortion and also a right to contraception. And that will be on the ballot on November 5th. And this is, you know, if the electorate chooses to pass it, this will, you know, end a 2-year process to do this. What's really interesting to me is that, you know, this started 2 years before the expected decision that is supposed to come out of the Supreme Court, which will basically overturn Roe v. Wade. And so, you know, this is expected to protect the right to an abortion in Vermont, and also create a protection that would be very difficult to remove, right? If this was simply a law codifying the right to an abortion in Vermont, which we have, there's this concern that that would be, you know, too easily overturned if the, you know, the makeup of the legislature were to change. A constitutional amendment is a constitutional change is much harder to do.
Well, we'll have to end there with that look ahead to the November elections and votes on Prop 5. Lola Dufour is a political reporter for VT Digger. Lola, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
We are also joined today by Bob Kinzel, VPR's senior political reporter. Bob, always a pleasure.
It's always a pleasure for me too, Michaela.